This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace.
Star musician, multimillionaire D4VD, a.k.a. David Anthony Burke, according to documents that we have received from the district attorney's office, stood by and watched while Celeste, 13-year-old schoolgirl, Celeste, bled in a kiddie pool that he ordered from Amazon. Repeat, according to these documents, the musician D4VD stands by and watches this little girl bleed in a kiddie pool he gets on Amazon that he hides down in his basement. Can anybody say death penalty? Because I can. The people's brief regarding preliminary hearing evidence. And it is full of the most incendiary facts I can think of. Correction to me. You, Dave Mack, Crime Stories investigative reporter. I said 13, but isn't it true that this document reveals David Anthony Burke lured this little girl at age 11 years old?
That's exactly right, Nancy. 11 years old, documented. That's the first time David Anthony Burke met Celeste Rivas.
And isn't it true, Dave Mack? I'm looking through the preliminary hearing brief. We find out that D4VD, David Anthony Burke, the multimillionaire, went to the effort to go to the school playground, the school, the elementary school, and pays another kid $1,000 to give Celeste Rivas a secret cell phone so they can send naughty pictures to each other. Isn't that true?
Yeah, because that's exactly true, Nancy, because Celeste's family, they found out what was going on and took away her cell phone. They found Burke's number in her personal cell phone, and they said no, and they took away her cell phone. Burke found out a sneaky way, paid one of her child friends to $1,000. Think about a kid getting $1,000 to give her a secret cell phone.
Cruel. But what is so upsetting? It's all upsetting. But joining me now is a special guest, Dr. Kendall Crowns. He is the chief medical examiner, Tarrant County. He is the host of a hit podcast, Mayhem in the Morgue. He is the esteemed lecturer at the Burnett School of Medicine at TCU. I can go on and on and on, but let me just stop with chief medical examiner, Tarrant County. Dr. Kendall Crowns, how long does it take for a human, much less a child, a little girl, to bleed out, exsanguinate?
So it depends on what's cut. If you get your carotids, your jugulars cut in your neck, you're going to bleed out in a matter of under a minute or so. If your heart's stabbed, you're going to bleed out, and again, under a minute or so. But in the information that we have, she's stabbed in the abdomen, in the chest, one wound going into her liver. The liver is a very vascular organ. She's going to bleed internally into her abdominal cavity. She'll probably die in under 10 minutes from blood loss.
So we've got a max 10 minutes?
About that, yes.
Okay. Let's just hold on to that thought one moment. Susan Hendricks joining us in addition to Dr. Kendall Crowns and Dave Mack. Susan Hendricks, investigative reporter, journalist, author of a bestseller, Down the Hill, My Descent into the Double Murder in Delphi. That's talking about Abby and Libby that were murdered by Richard Allen in Delphi. Susan, this document by the state, by the prosecutors, states that D4VD stood by and watched Celeste, this little girl, bleed, wait for it, in a blue kiddie pool that he, idiot, bought on Amazon. And isn't it true, Susan Hendricks, that minute, microscopic bits of blue plastic were found in the incise in the wounds to her body. And we were thinking, what is that? Of course, they had to take the tissue, take her skin, and look at it under a microscope. And then they went, what are these blue particles? It's the kiddie pool.
Yep. And now we know what it was. And fitting for her, they met when she was 11, still having braces, goes to her middle school. When he finds out, her mom says he can't see her anymore, took her phone away. I know, I'll go to the middle school, give a kid $1,000. The kiddie pool. It's fitting for Celeste. The details here, exactly what the DA Hoffman said. Nathan, he said there are special circumstances, and I agree. It's laid out perfectly.
Trey Lovell joining us. He is a veteran trial lawyer in this jurisdiction of LA. He is the founder of the Lovell Law Firm. You can find him at lovellfirm.com. Trey, explain what special circumstances are.
So special circumstances are an enhancement to a first-degree murder charge. Typically, a first-degree murder charge requires premeditation and intent. It has a penalty of 25 years to life. Special enhancement means you're adding certain circumstances that make it extra egregious. You know, you're lying in wait. You're doing it for financial gain. You're trying to kill a witness. You're killing multiple people. I think there's maybe up to 12 different types of instances in California law that entitle upgrading the first degree murder charge to special enhancement, which then qualifies you for the death penalty.
And of course, the defense will put up minimizing circumstances to try to get a jury to mitigate or to bring down the sentence. But either way, if he's convicted, he's looking at LWOP, life without parole, or the death penalty, which, of course, in California, there's a moratorium, but that's not going to last forever. Everybody waiting for their turn on death row may very well get their turn. Back to Susan Hendricks. The blue particles found in and on her body. I pointed out that this document, this people's brief regarding the preliminary hearing evidence, reveals that idiot D4VD, the multimillionaire, on the cusp, like the night before he starts his world tour and drops his album, is in the basement rendering her body. Did he order the pool, the inflatable kiddie pool, on Amazon? And if so, what else did he order on Amazon?
Yes, he did. And I have a list. I mean, it goes on and on. Just the convenience to him of this. And at first, Nancy, you mentioned the pool. I thought it was a tarp. And now, more horrific that we know it was a kiddie pool. Here's the list. Two chainsaws, a shovel from Home Depot, a burn cage on Amazon. I didn't know what that was. Garbage bags again. The list goes on and on. I'm picturing them just scrolling and ordering to get rid of this young girl.
Speaking of the burn cage, joining us, as I mentioned, Steve Fisher, missing persons private investigator, search and rescue expert, owner of Search Investigations. He was hired by the owner of that million-dollar mansion in Hollywood Hills that D4VD rented, and this is where Celeste was murdered. So to you, Steve Fisher, I want to talk about the burn cage. But first, let's see a shot that we got from our friends at TMZ of the side of D4VD's mansion. Because one of those shots shows the garage. There's the garage where he hid Celeste's body in the kiddie pool, Steve Fisher. Were you ever in that garage?
Yeah, several times. And so that garage is really key because, one, there was only one key to the house. And often that wasn't with the people. So they would use that garage door closest to that gate. They would, you know, open the door and then leave the door unlocked and go in. So they're always going through the garage. And you turn that into like a game room down there. That's where people would hang out as friends and everything. I just don't understand how this went unnoticed, if it did go unnoticed.
Okay. Whoa. You're telling me something new, Fisher. And I'm glad to hear it. So I had envisioned a regular people garage, you know, where you put all your spare tools and your stuff that you don't want in your kitchen. Tell me about his garage, because that is where the kiddie pool was. And that is where, according to the state, David Anthony Burke murdered Celeste, and he put her in a kiddie pool so she wouldn't get blood on his floor.
Yeah, exactly. And so originally when they rented it, the owner had it like as a home gym type of thing, but he changed it. And with that, it had these like rubber floors on it. Not something you'd park a car on necessarily, more for like gym equipment and on the other two bays. And this one, it did just have the brick. And they had actually started, they'd got a red Tesla and it was starting to park inside the garage. But that door you see on the left there with the one step, that goes up into the house. And that's what they use many times to get up there.
Let's see a shot that we got from our friends at TMZ. Am I looking at the garage right now? Is that what I'm seeing, Steve Fisher?
Yes, you are. You're looking at the far left bay if you're looking at the house.
That doesn't look like a hangout, like where people sit on sofas and watch TV.
There's two more garage doors just to the right of the frame. And those are the ones that have a rubber floor down on the ground. And then there was like games and stuff like that.
Is it open or is there a wall between what I'm seeing and the game area?
It's open. You just, if that shot tilted a little bit more to the right, you'd be able to see it.
I'm looking in the garage where Celeste was murdered.
Yes, you are. Tragic.
Steve, when you were there, had police already processed it for blood?
They had, and this is where I still have a little confusion because I did not see them turn it into a crime scene. I didn't see them using Tevex suits. I didn't see them there for an extremely long period of time. So I don't know if they got this off of something, things that they took from the garage, such as the pool and whatnot, but it wasn't processed like you would expect to see if they saw
the
signs
pool
of rendering.
Are you talking about the kiddie pool?
Talking about the kiddie pool, yeah.
Well, I'm looking. Hey, blood can microscopic bits of blood can naked to the human eye can be there for years, actually. So hold on to you, Susan Hendricks. I'm looking again at this document, and I'm specifically looking at page 6. It says LAPD served a search warrant at this address, 1368 Doheny Place, September 17. Hold that date in your mind. Hold that date in your mind, Steve Fisher. September 17, after the victim was ID'd by the ME, based on dental records, which is a whole other can of worms, Dr. Kendall Crowns. Why dental records? In the garage, detectives discovered evidence consistent with the rendering of her body in the inflatable pool, which contained multiple linear cuts. Biological samples positive for blood were collected within the garage area. DNA determined it was Celeste. So there had to be blood on the walls or the floor that the 4VD did not see to clean up.
Yeah, and did he do it by himself? That's a question I have. And why wasn't it held blocked off as a crime scene for a longer period of time? We've covered other cases. Clearly, Nancy Guthrie, you leave the crime scene too soon. What evidence is missing? And hopefully they got it all in that garage. If that's where everything happened, we do know the Tesla started to smell in that area. Parked a couple hundred feet from his home, people started to smell decomposition. And then it was towed. I think the evidence is in that garage clearly, and the Tesla.
Well, obviously they used luminol. They may have used an alternative light source, ALS, but clearly they used either luminol or ALS, where microscopic bits of blood that you can't see if you look like Steve Fisher. What date were you in the garage, Steve?
It would have been just a couple days later after the search warrant was served.
Okay, and I bet you didn't see any blood, so they had to use luminol to find the blood. But did they find the kiddie pool?
By reading the document, it seems like they may have, and which, you know, I know that there's the pieces of it, but you know, here's the thing, like you can watch that search warrant being executed from the helicopter footage, the raw helicopter footage from the news helicopter above, and they're standing around in the garage. It does not look like it's the focus. It looks like the focus is the electronics up in the house. So I'm wondering if this was fully processed.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace.
Trey Lovell joining us, defense attorney and founder of the Lovell Firm. I'm going to go back to Steve Fisher because he is sharing with us tonight video of the Tesla being moved and driven out of the home with Celeste's body in it. Trey Lovell, don't you hate it when your client basically has a shopping list? I mean, can you imagine D4BD? Let's see here. I'm going to need a couple of shovels. I'm going to need a home incinerator. Check, check, check. Oh, yeah, the kiddie pool. Check, check, check. Really? There's records of that. Does the name Brian Koberger ring a bell? That devil, straight from hell, ordered the murder weapon on Amazon, a K-bar knife, and that cracked the case, other than the identification of his white Elantra, with his DNA on the sheath of the murder weapon. So you've got him ordering that from Amazon. Oh, here's a good one. Cult mom Lori Vallow. May she rot in hell. She murdered not only her two children, JJ and Tylee, but the wife of her then lover, the self-proclaimed prophet, Chad Daybell. So before Tammy Daybell, his wife, dies of natural causes, later to be determined homicide, she, cult mom Lori Vallow, goes online, like the big idiot she is, and orders her wedding dress and her ring and her groom, the prophet, Chad Daybell's beach, B-E-A-C-H, groom outfit. And then they wore it after Tammy died on the beach at Hawaii for their wedding. Thanks, Amazon. Awesome.
Listen, that doesn't help at all, obviously. But I want to stress one thing. We are at the beginning of this, and we've only seen the prosecution side. And there's a lot of questions that arise around here. Why wasn't this the garage fully processed as a crime scene? You know, David had a lot going on from the day that he allegedly killed Celeste, from the 23rd to the 25th. He had a party to go to. His album was coming out. He's around PR people. He's around his management. You know, how could this have happened without somebody knowing it and being in on it? So there's a lot of questions about this that really need to be answered before we can really kind of lock in our idea of what happened here.
We are learning so much from this document. Before I go back into it with Susan Hendricks, to Steve Fisher joining us, missing persons private investigator, owner of Search Investigations, who actually went through D4VD's mansion. Let's look at the video that you are allowing us to show tonight and explain in your own words what it reveals. We're going to loop it over and over while you talk.
So this is July 29th, 2025, which is the last day David's in town before he gets on a tour bus to start his tour. This is the Tesla being moved from the rental house, which is just around the greenery there where it originally comes from. It's just around the corner. It's coming down the street towards to connect with the Bluebird. It's about 10:30 in the morning. It's being moved. The windows cracked down. It's very dirty. You can tell that the windshield wiper has been run like once or twice to clear enough dust. So it's been sitting, you know, to where it accumulated that. And, you know, it's being moved by somebody that's light-skinned, is wearing red jersey type shirt and has long hair. And, you know, it's the last time that we see the Tesla.
Is it a male or a female moving the Tesla?
Appears to me to be a male.
And you say the window is down. We can see that because of the stench of this little girl's decomposing body in the front trunk.
Yeah, they've been sitting there out on the street.
Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, it's just been, see, he just left it out there with her remains in it. And just like he couldn't let her go for some reason and was keeping it either as a trophy or for control purposes. I never understand that. But she'd been there most likely for months, like it says in the document.
And we are seeing the car pull out from D4VD's home, correct? Right around the corner to the right?
Yeah, it's about, you know, 150 feet, 200 feet the most.
Back to what we know. What was the date that the car was driven out?
July 29th.
And tell me about the timing of D4VD's world tour and the drop of his album.
Yes, yeah, so they leave later that late in the afternoon. He does a Instagram post of some sort or video from a tour bus and saying the tour is starting tonight. They're getting on a tour bus. They leave. I believe they go to San Francisco for the first show, and it shows him, Neo, and Asia on this tour bus, and that's it right there. They're leaving, and this is the beginning of the tour. David does not come back until after the search warrants served, and I don't believe Asia does either. She left her car there the entire time, the house. Neo, I think, did come back.
To Susan Hendricks, joining us, investigative journalist and author, the night prosecutors say that D4VD David Anthony Burke murdered Celeste, what did he do that night?
That night, it appears, so it's less than 24 hours later, he goes to his album's launch party. That's April 24th. He goes to the launch party less than 24 hours after he allegedly killed her, ordering a shovel on Home Depot. And Steve's timeline really helps, and that's key. I believe it will be key in the case on what he did, and shows to me the callousness of it. Going on tours, he mentioned, as Steve mentioned, in July, the last time he drove that Tesla as she's rotting in the front of that car. Also, a launch party. And as you said, Nancy, nothing was going to stop this guy from moving forward with his career. Not a second thought to killing this girl who he met at the age of 11 while she still had braces.
To you, Steve Fisher, you have fleshed out a timeline. Tell me what you've learned about the movements of David Anthony Burke, a.k.a. D4VD, around, during, and after the night Celeste Rivas was murdered in his basement.
Yeah, so April 23rd, he sends her an Uber. One of the biggest things to me is to find out that she was in Lake Elsinore at home and on a school night, still not reported, found. She brings her 80 miles to his house, apparently kills her right away. And that's April 23rd. He goes to Santa Barbara County. And the 24th, just hours later, he's having a album release party at A Thousand Thieves, which is a venue here in Culver City. And then has the pre-sale starts, the tour's officially launched, and within another 24 hours, he's in New York City, a Band Lab three-day pop-up where he's performing live. But within 12, 14 hours of taking a 14-year-old's life, he is arms up in the air celebrating at 100 Thieves that his album has launched and has dropped, and it's sick, and there he is, and they're celebrating. It's on. It's, man, everything is great, and Celeste is decomposing. It's tragic.
You know, the cold nature to Trey Lovell. He is a veteran defense attorney who's tried a lot of cases in this jurisdiction of LA. Him going and partying after rendering her body, like at a slaughterhouse, that will infuriate a jury.
This is something that can help the defense, because it's not conduct consistent with having murdered somebody. You know, immediately going out afterwards, having this busy schedule, showing no remnants of having committed a murder. This actually can help the defense to show there's some other, maybe somebody was trying to help him and did it without his knowledge. And I'm just purely speculating. It's not what the evidence shows now, but we've only seen one side of the evidence. And so as a defense lawyer, I'm going to look at this and say, hey, what did he do afterwards that's consistent with having committed this crime? And his conduct is not. And there's a lot of people around. Somebody would have known about it. Nobody knew about it. So these are things that a defense attorney is going to latch onto and try to exploit to poke holes in the prosecution's case.
Straight out to Dave Matt, Crime Stories investigative reporter, also joining us. Jump in, Dave.
Nancy, there's a really important factor here of how quickly Burke was establishing the alibi. Got to remember, on the 22nd, Celeste threatens to go public with their relationship. That's how upset she is. That's why she is texting to Burke. He gets her to come to the house on the 23rd, sends the Uber. She shows up at 10 minutes after 10. Nancy, by 10:30, it is believed that Celeste was already dead, and Burke begins texting Celeste's phone. He sends a text, "Where are you?" after she's already dead. April 23rd, 11:30 p.m., Burke drives away from his home, texting and calling Celeste's phone, asking where she is. He's setting up the defense. April 24th, between 12:01 and the early morning hours, that's when Burke drives a Tesla to Santa Barbara County, attempting to dispose of some of Celeste's property, and evidence that Burke returns to his home in the early morning hours of April 24th, 2025. In those first 12 hours, Nancy, from the time of her death until the time he returns from Santa Barbara, he is building an alibi.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace.
Our director in the control room is obsessed with some photos. These photos allegedly taken by D4VD holding the knives. And I recognize the fingernail polish and the hand, Trey Lovell. And I'm sure you would argue to a jury, you can't tell that's D4VD holding that. But please, I would make him hold his hand up in front of the jury and let them decide. What the hey, Lovell, is he doing taking pictures of knives? Did he use those to murder and render down Celeste's body?
Listen, the defense is going to come up with an explanation for that. You know, what's the time frame? What's the context? When were those pictures taken? What was the purpose of those? You know, is there enough distance between the murder and those pictures? You know, once again, not conduct consistent with showing off that you have the propensity to kill somebody. So these are things the defense is going to focus on, and the timeline, they're going to go, you know, meticulously about that. Is it accurate? Did it really happen? Was there another reason that he could have gone out there? There's a lot of things that the defense is going to focus on. They're going to have their own witnesses. And so once again, I keep coming back to it. We've seen one side of it. And it's big. There's a lot of evidence here. However,
Trey,
I promise you, you're going to see a difference.
You know, this is why you win so many cases. Trey, this is a little spoiled brat boy. Right? He's living with his wealthy parents who are funding his musical aspirations. You're saying we don't know the context of these knife photos. What is he, an Eagle Scout? He's going to go, gather wood for a fire and pitch a tent and sing around the campfire and toast marshmallows? O-H-E-L-L-N-O. That's not why he has this knife. Lovell, did you actually just say that with a straight face?
I'm telling you, we've seen one side of the evidence here. Wait till we see the witnesses that defense are going to produce. We're going to see holes being poked through this. So it's not clear. Yes, he's holding up a knife. It doesn't look good. But context is everything. Factual matters are everything. And once again, conduct not consistent with a murderer, you know, to go and show off. So I think, you know, we're going to find out a whole other side to what happened here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Steve Fisher, these are your photos. The photos of D4VD and his black fingernails. That's him holding the knives. What is that all about?
Yeah, just to clarify, they're not my photos. They're David. We found a car SD card at the house, and they're from David's camera. These are photos, and some of these included Celeste in them. These are photos taken. That one, I believe, is December 31st of 24. And she's in some subsequent photos that he took of her. They're in downtown right around midnight. He seemed to have a real thing for knives. And I understand there can be other, you know, explanations. It just kind of shows that he did have this thing.
What? No. You and Lovell together. You're the devil's duo. What do you mean he had, there are other explanations, he had other interests in knives? What interest would that be?
No, I'm not saying that this knife is the one that was used or anything like that to kill her. What I'm saying is we found evidence that he has like an obsession with knives. There was a lot of, he even on live streams brought this other knives out that were like switchblades. And people warned him, like, you can't show that on YouTube. And
Well, you know what, Steve Fisher, you just keep making up excuses for D4VD, because I'm going to go to Kendall Crowns right now. Let's talk about chainsaws, Dr. Kendall Crowns. Isn't it true that D4VD idiot ordered chainsaws from Amazon? I mean, or was it Lowe's? One of the two, but there's a record of him ordering a chainsaw. Let's talk about what a chainsaw can do to a human body.
Certainly. So I have my chainsaw here at the office. And a chainsaw is actually not the best way to tear apart a body. And because basically the way a chainsaw goes through, it chips or planes the wood. And so when it cuts into tissue, it creates a large spray of tissue and blood. And then when it gets into the bone, it continues to make this spray. It, in fact, can shoot several feet away from the chainsaw in front of it. You'll get casts off coming from this direction, underneath, and out the chute on the side here. It would come out here on the bottom. So it shoots blood and debris and bone everywhere. It's not a good way to disarticulate a body because it puts DNA all over the place and just rips the hell out of the tissue as it's doing it.
While we are on the topic of chainsaws, Dr. Kendall Crowns, who, let me remind everyone, Chief Medical Examiner, Tarrant County, that's Fort Worth, star of Mayhem in the Morgue, and esteemed lecturer at the Burnett School of Medicine at TCU. Very often when we have cases where the victim has been rendered, or as you said, disarticulated, you have to look at tool marks, as we call them, on the limbs. What are they? And how would a chainsaw tool mark be identifiable?
So the different tools that you can use to disarticulate a person, knives, axes, chainsaws, saws, they all create marks on the bone. And one of these, the marks are called kerf marks or kerf grooves. Chainsaws make a very distinctive wide kerf mark. And then you can look at the edges of the bone that have been cut and you can see different marks or tool marks on these bones that can kind of pinpoint the different types of saws, knives, whatever may be used to disarticulate a person.
How long do you believe it would take, Dr. Kendall Crowns, to disarticulate a body with a chainsaw versus a traditional knife?
So with knives, if you're going for joint spaces, like, you know, the joint spaces, wrist, elbow, shoulder, you can actually take the limb off relatively quickly, much like parting out a chicken, so to say. With a saw, hand saws, it takes a fair bit of effort to get through the skin, subcutaneous tissue, muscle, then to the bone. A chainsaw probably will cut through quite faster. So I would say it probably each cut would take a few minutes to get through the body. I think they made a total of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 cuts. So we're probably talking about 15, 20 minutes for them to completely saw through the body. And then the interesting thing is if she's still in that blue plastic swimming pool, as they cut too far through the body, they probably hit that swimming pool with the chainsaw edge and then ripped the plastic, which would then indiscriminately be pulled up back through the tissue and then lodge in the body.
Which explains the blue particles of plastic within the cuts on her body. Dr. Kendall Crowns, don't move, please. Susan Hendricks, there's so much in this document. I haven't even gotten to the Plan B, B as in brother pills, the oral contraceptive a day late, talk of abortion, nudie shots, you name it. Describe.
That will be used for evidence, in my opinion, on the text messages back and forth. We do know they have an argument on the 22nd. Everything you mentioned as well. Inappropriate, to put it mildly. Pictures, abortion, Plan B, and the argument back and forth to where she was jealous that he was with other, I learned today there were minors as well, was with other minors. So therefore, I think that's 100% motive that he's thinking when she says, look, I'm going to tell people about our quote unquote relationship, inappropriate again. And therefore, he decides to eliminate her, get rid of her, and ordering everything he needed to do that, even ordering her through an Uber to get to his house.
So Dr. Kendall Crowns, if this little girl had undergone an abortion, would you be able to determine that in autopsy?
there could be still changes in the ovaries that showed the significant changes that usually happen when an individual is pregnant. There's changes in the ovaries we can see grossly and histologically, or at the time of autopsy or under the microscope. There can also be on the uterus itself, what is called the endometrial cavity or the inside of the uterus. This usually gets a lot thicker when an individual is pregnant and becomes a lot more bloody or hemorrhagic. And the hormones of the ovaries will keep it in place. So there are changes we can see at autopsy that can indicate a pregnancy or a recent abortion. It just depends on the time frame of when it occurred, what we'll be able to find at autopsy.
If you know or think you know anything about the murder of Celeste Rivas, may she rest in peace. Dial 213-486-6890. Repeat, 213-486-6890. We remember American hero Detective Corporal Christopher Mock, St. Lucie County Sheriff's, Florida. Passed away in the line of duty after 21 years, leaving behind his wife, Jennifer, and two little children, Jasmine and Adrian. American hero, Detective Corporal Christopher Mock. Thank you to our guests, but especially to you for being with us tonight as we seek justice for Celeste. Nancy Gray signing off, and I'll see you tomorrow night, and until then.
This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.